Welcome to Drink Beer, Think Beer, the podcast that gets to the bottom of every pint. I'm John Hall. How do beers evolve over time? And how does patience, curiosity, trust, and creativity work to the benefit of both the brewery and the brewer? Wayne Wombles, the longtime former brewmaster of Cigar City, is here to talk about his career, a return to home brewing, and how specialty ingredients work best when added to a solid beer base. First, please go visit allaboutbeer.com. There, you can find original articles, reviews, news, insights, and podcasts. You can listen to shows like Brewer to Brewer and the All About Beer podcast simply by searching All About Beer wherever you listen to shows. And make sure to follow All About Beer on Instagram, Threads, X, and Facebook at All About Beer. And to keep up with all of the smoked beer news and releases, check out This Week in Rauch Beer. You can search the group on Facebook or follow at TW Rauch Beer on X, Threads, and Instagram. There's also limited edition apparel available on allaboutbeer.com/merch. This show and all of the work we do, it's supported by you. Please go visit patreon.com/allaboutbeer. A few bucks goes a long way to keep the content fresh and to fund writers, photographers, creators, and editors. And if you'd like to learn more about advertising on this show, any of our shows, or on the website, please email info@allaboutbeer.com. Wayne Wombles came to beer after a career in kitchens. He was inspired to brew early on, as so many other brewers of his generation, by reading the books of Charlie Papazian. His time homebrewing, as you'll hear, played an important part in shaping who he would become as a brewer. There were a few stepping stones on his early path that would ultimately lead to Cigar City in Florida, where he was brewmaster for nearly 16 years, shepherding beers like Hi Li and Hunapu into the beer consciousness, all while tweaking and perfecting those recipes and playing with variants. Fireman Capital, a private equity firm, purchased Cigar City in 2016. It already had Oscar Blues and other breweries in a portfolio that would be dubbed Canarchy going forward. Canarchy was sold to Monster Beverage in 2022, and a few weeks ago, Wombles was laid off from the company. Last week, news came out that a dozen additional members of the Cigar City brewing staff were also let go. It's fully unclear what this means for the brand or innovation, but Monster has been making alcoholic versions of its energy drink in recent years and now has a hard iced tea. Wombles may not be associated with the brewery anymore, but he's not leaving beer. He's going back to his roots and reflecting on a career filled with joy, education, and creativity, and it's fueling whatever might come next. He's also consulting for breweries these days, as you'll hear, offering his expertise to real breweries that need it. He joined me from North Carolina via Zoom. Here's our conversation. Wayne, thanks for doing this. I know there's a lot to talk about with your professional brewing career, but do you remember the first homebrew recipe you ever made?
Of course, yeah. I distinctly remember it because it was so terrible. It was an Irish dry stout that I brewed back in 1993 and obviously had a lot to learn and ended up having chlorophenols in that particular beer, and I ended up choking it down anyway, just because I was so proud that I actually made a beer. So it's kind of funny how much things have changed since then.
I mean, clearly, in all the years that I've known you, of all the beers of yours that I've had, I don't think I've ever had a bad pint. But that's got to be heartening to folks who are listening to know that your first homebrew batch was not what you wanted it to be, but there's hope going forward. What strikes me as interesting is that you even remember the specific off flavors that you got from it.
It's hard to forget that one. And, you know, sharing it with friends and everything, they're like, what's wrong with this? But I was just happy that I actually made it. So, you know, it's just, but it's one of those memories, you know, like, the first time you do something, whether it's bad or a good thing, you're probably going to remember it.
So like so many others, it was, Charlie Papazian's book that, if I'm remembering correctly, got you started. But you were in a food background beforehand. I mean, you were in a, you know, professional cooking. Yeah.
I worked in restaurants for about 12 years, and I went to local community college, and I was thinking of going into environmental engineering, and then quickly decided that that was probably not the best pursuit for me. And but I was inspired by working in restaurants and coming across certain beers, even though this small town that I grew up in Enterprise, Alabama, which is Southeast Alabama, there wasn't a whole lot of variety back in the early 90s. But I was working in different restaurants. I worked in an Italian restaurant, a Greek restaurant, Mexican restaurant. I worked in so many different environments with cultural differences that it was inspiring and fascinating to me, because it took me away from Southern cooking, which is what I grew up with in Southeast Alabama. And that was one of the links that kind of pushed me towards beer, in addition to Papazian's book. But unfortunately, I ended up reading The Homebrewer's Companion first, which was utterly confusing to me, and I almost didn't start brewing beer because that was the next book in a series, and yeah. It was geared more towards the intermediate to advanced. So I kept thinking, what am I missing here? And then I finally realized I missed the whole book, and I went back and read the first book, and then it made a lot more sense then.
I like that. I mean, gosh, if it wasn't for actually going back and finding that original one, we might have been deprived of all of your beers. You might be in a kitchen somewhere. I'm sure running an award-winning restaurant. But what was it about the connection when you made that jump? When you first started homebrewing, when you got interested in homebrewing, was it in the same way that you were exposed to Southern cooking growing up and then exposed to new flavors from these kitchens that you were working with? Was it just the pursuit of different to you flavors?
I think part of it was about deprivation, because growing up in that area, there wasn't, like I said, there weren't a whole lot of options. So my solution to that was start brewing beer, start creating my own options, and making beer in such a way to where the beers that I couldn't get, if I made them, maybe I could understand what made them what they are. Because I was also reading, you know, like Michael Jackson's books on all these different beers and his travels and how they reflected in this way and that way. But I couldn't get those beers. So I started making beers at home, kind of like from a self-educational perspective, but also because I couldn't get the things that I wanted to learn about. So I think that was a really big part of it. And, you know, obviously some of these inspirations that came from my experience in restaurants sort of leaked into some of the beers over time as well.
How quickly in your homebrewing experience did you go back to trying to make the dry Irish stout better?
Oh man, I actually have my first book, where I logged all the recipes that I was brewing at the time. I probably did it within the first year, but that memory is less at the forefront than actually brewing the first terrible one. So I'm not completely sure what kind of changes that I made to it. But I do remember I made an espresso imperial stout, and it was an espresso India imperial stout. That was one of those hard balancing acts, and it actually wasn't bad. That's the next stout that kind of stands out in my mind after the first brew that turned out less than preferable.
Yeah, it's interesting, although it really shouldn't be a surprise that stouts played a big role for you in home brewing, because I mean, you're obviously celebrated for so many of the stouts that you put out into market over your years at Cigar City. Do you think you would have been on a different trajectory if your first batch had been an amber ale or something?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that I was going to eventually, you know, try to learn as much as possible, regardless of what my starting point was. The thing about stouts, though, is just it's the fact that there's so many malt options, and you know, you can do so many different things with the malts to create different profiles, and you don't have to worry about color. You know, as long as it's dark, it doesn't matter. So there's no worry about, you know, making a pilsner that's too dark or something like that. It gives you a lot of freedom to really create some rich, complex flavors. And then it just becomes more about balance. You know, I don't want some ashy, super astringent from dark malt thing in most cases. So there is a balance aspect, but you know, there's really a lot of opportunity there to create a lot of depth and complexity in stouts.
So as you started your professional brewing career, do you remember the first professional stout you made?
It actually took a while, and I didn't make it at the first brewery that I worked at. The first brewery that I worked at was Poplar Head Mule Company, which was a small brew pub in Dothan, Alabama. And they pretty much already had existing styles. That was around like 96 or so. So at that point, my goal was really to try to make whatever they were making at the time better, or, you know, like just do the best I could with what was in front of me, because they had three brands that were pretty well established. So it's just trying to maintain or improve upon those. I mean, I was given a brewer's tap, like specialty tap or whatever, but I never would put a stout in that position because the market just wasn't ready for something like that. Not in that location. So it wasn't until Buckhead Brewery and Grill in Tallahassee, Florida, where I started doing things like that. And that's really where my career started, because I was given a great deal of creative freedom there that I'd never been given before.
So when you had that creative freedom, when you had that trust, where did you put it? Like, what were the resulting beers from that?
There were, so Buckhead and Tallahassee, a lot of the beers that I were brewing were, they were traditionally oriented, but focused on different yeast strains. And in some cases focused on different, hop varieties and different techniques. You know, for instance, I was doing Cooler Whirlpool hopping on the hot side back in like 1997, 1998. Huh. So I was, you know, running through the heat exchanger and then running back into the kettle, getting it down to like 190 to 195. And then adding my Whirlpool hops. And I was doing those tests back in the late 90s. And I would put them in front of homebrewers that would come in, and they'd be like, I can't tell a difference. But I could, you know, I could tell that it was making a difference. Process differences like that were big for me. Just doing anything I could like that to kind of like learn how does this smell or taste different if I run the process like this, if I ferment this yeast at this temperature. Do I get, you know, like more or less ester production? Those earlier days were more looking at commercial applications without getting into crazy things, you know, like putting chili peppers and things like that into beer. It was more about how do I refine my process? How do I make my traditional styles as solid as possible? Because once I get those things down, and what comes later is me doing crazy things with those things that I developed back then. So yeah. It was a great starting point where I was given enough freedom to be able to see the results of the things that I was doing and create strong base beers.
And that's, I feel like that's so important, right? Of even today with beers and breweries that are out there, of maybe not having that strong base beer. You know, okay, it's like, oh yeah, we're going to add chilies, or we're going to add adjuncts, we're going to add, you know, something crazy, but the base beer itself doesn't necessarily lend to those adjuncts, to those ingredients. And I don't know, maybe it's just this is me sort of spiraling now, but it's the work that had been done early on with normalizing things like chilies in beer or chocolate in beer or whatever. There's maybe not the same focus on the base recipe that maybe there I definitely needed to be back then when you were doing this, but probably should right now. So I guess the long wind up is, do you feel those beers that you would make later on in your career would have landed in the same way if you didn't put that work in back then in Tallahassee?
I don't think so. And the crazy thing about it is the fact that Maduro, I made that in Tallahassee before it ever got made at Cigar City Brewing.
The brown ale.
Marshall Zukov's Imperial Stout, that was made in Tallahassee the first time before it ever got brewed at Cigar City Brewing. A lot of the beers that were used as base beers years later in Tampa were developed at Buckhead Brewery in Tallahassee. And then I just sort of held on to those concepts until I got to a position where I could do different things with them. And it was a real big, huge building block for Tampa.
Again, it kind of goes to those dark ales, though. Some of those, those darker malts, but that have, you know, that soul, but also, you know, that the good body to them. And I always thought Maduro was fairly refreshing as well. Like it, when I was in Tampa, it was one of those beers that I enjoyed drinking in the tap room, when it was 95 degrees out. You mentioned, you know, messing around with malts before and specialty malts and, you know, trying to find different things that worked. When you were building out some of those recipes and messing around with malts, were there results that were surprising to you in a good way?
With specialty malts.
Or even just the malts that you were putting together for a lot of these dark ales that you were brewing.
I'd already had such a, I'd already created such a foundation and understanding for a lot of what I was doing with a dark malt that it no longer was how much of it to use or how to mix it. It was, you know, like how to combine them. It was more of, you know, which malts their best fit my desired profile, because, you know, is it Baird? Is it Simpson? You know, like, who is it? Because that was the new goal. Once I got to that point, I didn't have access to as many maltsters back in Tallahassee. That was one of the bad things. It was pretty much only Breach is who we had access to. So I was limited to that. But once I got to Tampa, everything was wide open, which changed things dramatically. It allowed me to actually create beers regardless. I mean, I had access to everything, and I could literally brew test brews and fine tune it, keep changing out the maltster until I got it exactly where I wanted it. And that just wasn't an option in Tallahassee. So that was a really big, really big thing.
I like that. And it's also just, you know, that's a good reminder to, even if you have a malt provider, you know, that you like, to branch out and see what other folks have, because it might land a little different.
Yep, I totally agree.
So you've dialed in the recipes and you've built the base beers. And I remember one of the first times that I met you, gosh, I don't even know when it was now, but it was a long time ago. And we had a long conversation about various woods, and it wasn't even necessarily about, you know, the barrels themselves, because I, you know, and these days that topic is, you know, well, it's a bourbon barrel, it's a wine barrel, it's, you know, wow, this held tequila at some point and everything. But we had an actual conversation about, you know, aging beers on wood. And you were, if not the first, one of the very first in the U.S. To really be messing around with different types of woods and its effect on beer. And I remember somebody saying, it might have been you at the time, of just like, this is going to be the fifth ingredient, the fifth main ingredient in beer going forward. What did you learn about wood in your years, or what have you learned about wood in your years as a brewer?
I learned that there's a lot of opportunity for a pretty wide variety of infusing different character into beer by using wood as a raw material. But I also think it's important to understand that wood aged beer is not the same as barrel aged beer.
So
And
let's talk about that.
so if you want to make an IPA, you're gonna have a much more successful beer. If you want to make a wood aged IPA, you're gonna have a much more successful beer if you appropriately wood age it versus barrel age it. The difference to me between wood aging and barrel aging is low to zero dissolved oxygen ingress. And so you need a closed system. You need a way to, and ideally, you need a way to recirculate the beer through the wood that you can get faster extraction by conducting it like that. But if you can minimize oxidation and you can maximize wood impact and define the level of wood impact that you want, you'll get the beer that you want. But you'll rarely make a good IPA that is aged in a barrel versus wood infused. Those are just different things. And we learned that pretty quickly with the Spanish cedar aged Jylai. And it started off as being a static contact, which was added to fermentation, and eventually went to a separate tank, which we would recirculate the beer through with the wood spirals in it. And that was a huge difference, and that made a huge difference in the quality of that beer.
I remember cedar aged Jylai. I mean, you weren't making it all that often, right?
In the beginning, we were doing bottle conditioning. We made a decent amount of it, and then eventually it became like a seasonal, I think. It's never been a year-round beer, so we weren't. Yeah, it was never a core brand per se. It was more of like a seasonal, but it is also one of those polarizing beers. There are people that loved it, and there are people that just didn't care for it, because the character of the cedar imparts is can be overwhelming to some people.
So, what about experimentation when it comes to wood aged? Like,
Let's talk
how
about
much?
a couple of my favorite projects.
Okay, yeah.
One of my favorite projects with wood of all time was I was working with Darwin Brewing Company in Florida, and he is from Peru. He's actually a chef and makes some incredible ceviche, some of the best ceviche I've ever had. But he was able to bring in about 11 or 12 indigenous woods from Peru. And so basically what we did was we got all these crawlers, and we weighed out and approximated the same rough weight of wood per crawler. And then we filled all the crawlers with a neutral blonde beer. And then we put them into the refrigerator, and we let them all sit for like 2 weeks. Then we re-adjourned and drank through all these different types of woods that were from Peru. And we picked a single wood, and I can't remember the name of that wood right now. Unfortunately, I apologize.
It's okay.
But that was a really unique wood, and it sort of contributed a character that came across kind of like pear brandy. It just was really unique. And that was the wood that we used to make the collaborative beer with. There was another project that I worked on with Matt Brunelson at Firestone Walker, and it was an Imperial Brown Ale base, but it was infused with, what's the name of the wood that they age cachaça on?
Oh, I could pretend like I'd immediately know the answer to this, but I don't.
Yeah, well, it gives like this huge vanilla component. And it also has almost like this gingerbread spice sort of character to it. And that was one of the woods. And we also used an African wood that gives like chocolate notes. And that was but it was unique chocolate notes. So that was like, that was one of, probably might have been one of the best, more experimental wood age beers that I've ever made. It was a fantastic beer. When you looked at the spider chart for this thing, it was just full. I mean, completely full across the spider chart. It just it had so many different flavors, but it wasn't overwhelming. It was balanced and it was really pleasant. There was another project that we did with a Saison based beer, and we aged it on separately, lime, grapefruit, and lemon wood. And those were released separately at the same time. And you know, I was surprised by how different those three woods expressed in the beer. But they were all complementary. So those are probably some of my favorite wood projects that come to mind immediately.
I like that. And I like that you were constantly messing around with it as well and trying to put this culinary aspect into it, right? Because I think a lot of the time when folks are tasting, let's just say barrel aged right now, they're either going to get the whiskey that was in it beforehand, or they're going to get some of those wood tannins, you know, and even some of the fooder beers and things like that. And it's like, oh, this is kind of oaky or whatever. But all of the descriptions that you were just talking about from these woods had culinary words and experiences attached to them. And I wonder how much of your background, even as you were, your background in the kitchen, even as you were making some of those beers, but then just the everyday drinking beers that you made during your time in Tampa, how much did your culinary background influence those beers?
I think heavily,
like across the board. Yeah,
I think heavily, but I think you have to go back to my early homebrewing years to put all the pieces of the puzzle together.
Okay.
Because back in early homebrewing, you know, I was making much more culinary inspired beers. But I knew that commercially that wouldn't fly. Some of the culinary concepts I was making at home, the market wasn't ready for that. So in Tallahassee, that's when I built my base structure, my solid base styles. And then by the time I got to Tampa, that is when I could take those ideas from early homebrewing and put them into those solid base styles. And that is how I moved forward with Cigar City. Because prior to that, I wasn't allowed to take those culinary ideas and cross them with the beers that I was making. So Tampa was doors wide open, you know, do whatever you want. And it was awesome.
Yeah. I like that. When you look back, I know it's cliche to ask you about Hunapu, but I think it was such a formidable beer for so many people, and really helped launch a category and a movement that still continues pretty strongly these days. Are there ones that you look back at with particular fondness of all of the variants that you did, of all of the recipes that you did over the years?
Yeah, I think the very first double barrel aged was the best that we ever made. And there were some great years of, you know, non-variant. I think 2011 or 12, it's been a while. One of those was more chili forward. And that chili character actually held up really well. I think I had one of those like 8 years later. And but one of the issues became, you know, like, how do we have a consistent Scoville from year to year? And we had to eventually solve that equation, because the idea wasn't to make a super hot chili beer. It was to have enough Scoville that was heating you in the back of your throat to where you couldn't determine if it was the Scoville or if it was the 11.5 to 12% alcohol by volume that was causing your throat to feel that way. So creating that balance took some doing, but we eventually figured it out.
What was it about that double barrel that stuck out in your mind?
I just thought both the barrels were incredibly harmonious, and you know, I was getting elements from both the barrels, but they weren't overwhelming the base beer. And you know, a lot of times you end up with sometimes you end up with these beers that are excessively sweet, and that's not really what I look for in a barrel aged beer. I want the sweetness there for some balance, but if you don't have the elements of the barrel that are up more forward to help balance out the rest of the beer, then it's just one big diabetic mess, and that's definitely not what I was trying to do.
Yeah. It's so interesting to think back to like 2011, 2012, the beginning of the rise of Untappd, and everybody sort of becoming a critic and or heaping praise on a beer. In the years that I attended the festival that you all would have for Hunapu, you know, I was always sort of struck by the enthusiasm behind it. But also the lack of, what's a polite way of saying this? People weren't really taking their time with the beer. They weren't sitting and savoring. This was a fill your cup, chug it down, go on to the next one type of thing. And that's sort of my long setup for when you have a beer that captures the attention of so many, right? And there's going to be so many thoughts around it. I imagine there's a certain pressure that you as a brewer have to face in building it out. But did you have quiet moments with that beer or any of the beers that you made over time where you could remove yourself as a brewer and just appreciate the beer that you had made as a beer drinker?
Sure. And I'm glad you're asking this question, because, you know, that really goes back to, earlier in my career too. It wasn't uncommon for me to brew later in the day when I was working in Tallahassee. And you know, it wasn't uncommon for me to leave at 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning. And there would be evenings where it would just be me sitting in the pub, not a single soul there. And I would pull one of the beers that had just come on tap, or I'd pull several of them and just sit them on the table in front of me. And then I would drink through each one slowly and think to myself, did I achieve my goals here? You know, like, did I hit what I was striving for? And I think that was really the beginning of what you're talking about, trying to put myself in the position to where I'm asking myself, you know, like those tough questions and being very critical of myself, because it is extremely important to me that I was achieving what I'd set out to achieve. And that was really where all of that began. Yeah, if not before that, you know, evaluating my beers before entering them into homebrew competitions as a home brewer, you know, that also was a big thing for me, although that's different than looking at it from a consumer perspective. But yes, I've always tried to be really critical of what I'm doing and try to make sure that I'm hitting a mark that would, you know, like be pleasant for a drinker.
Yeah. Does it get harder to do when you think about those early days in Tallahassee versus, significant career that you've had since then. Is that something that gets harder to do over time? Or as you scale up?
That maybe as you scale up and you start going into distribution, there's less variety. And there is more of a focus on maintaining the existing brands, that especially the ones that are selling at volume. But you know, overall, moving forward, I think that we should continue to, you know, focus on traditional brands, well-produced traditional brands, because I don't see them going away. As well as being innovative and creating, you know, unique concepts. So I think that, you know, traditional brands are part of the history and soul of beer. And if those things are gone, then I think we have to ask ourselves, are we really drinking beer anymore?
You've been making beer again at home. I've seen some posts on social media over the last couple of weeks. What have you been firing up in the homebrew kettle?
So I brewed batch 56 since March of last year on the 8th of this month.
Wow. All
right. And it was an ordinary bitter, and it's going to be 3.5% alcohol by volume. Robust porter that I brewed before that. And as you probably saw, I've got an Irish red that turned out really great for St. Patrick's Day. I made a 3.5% Irish dry stout for St. Patrick's Day that turned out really nice.
I was going to ask if you went back to the dry stout.
Yeah. And it turned out really nice, even at 3.5. And upcoming, I'm about to brew a second pilot of Schwartz beer, first pilot of Dortmunder export, and brewing alt beer and a Kolsch. I did some research on those two styles. They were really interesting. Looking at the yeast genetics, it's interesting how the alt beer yeast strain and the Kolsch yeast strain are kind of branching out on similar branches, but are distinct. They're not the same yeast strains. So I'm brewing the alt beer with a traditional alt strain and the Kolsch with a traditional Kolsch strain. I've been digging a lot more into things like that lately on a homebrew level. Once again, that all goes back to how do I create the best example of a traditional beer? And it's all the details. If you don't have all the details, you know, like, are you really creating a great example of that beer?
It really does sound like you're giving yourself that freedom to explore, that freedom to educate yourself, you know, and it sounds similar to that opportunity that you had back at the beginning of your career, to really just sort of explore.
Does it
feel good to be homebrewing again? Yeah.
It feels so refreshing to be doing it again. It's like, it's not like starting over because I have all this knowledge, but it's just so refreshing to have the creative freedom to be able to do whatever I want and still be really critical on myself and try to make the best examples that I possibly can make of those things that I'm working on. You know, in some situations I've gotten up to the 6th and 7th pilots in the last year, and it's really allowed me to love brewing again. Some of the other things I've had to deal with in the past with the commercial focus, I just realized that these are not really the things that I love about brewing. So this homebrewing again has reinstilled that love back in me, and it's been awesome.
So you're not just homebrewing these days. I know you've made headlines, you know, that you're not with Cigar City anymore, but you're consulting. You're out there bringing your vast knowledge and expertise to folks who want it, and probably more importantly, the to the folks who need it. tell me about your consulting these days and where the people who need you can find you.
Well, I felt like, we have more breweries in this country than we've had in the history of this country. So
yep.
There have to be some people or some entities that could use some help. And I'm all about us as an industry making better beer, and 100% invested in helping to make that happen. I can be reached at waynewombles@yahoo.com. And it's probably the best way to reach me. And it's all one word, nothing in between the Wayne and Wombles. And just encourage people to reach out. And if they want to explore improvements or anything, then I'd love to help them.
Honestly, I can't think of a downside that anybody would get out of working with you. And I'm saying this as having been drinking your beers for so many years now. And I'll put that up on the website and everything for everybody who's listening. So you don't have to write it down if you're in the car right now. Wayne, I want to ask you the Green Door question. So on this show for a while now, I've been asking folks, the premise is there's a television show called The Good Place. And in the final season, they introduce a concept of a green door that folks can walk through and be anywhere doing whatever they want to be doing. And so if we had a green door on our plane of existence and you could walk through it after this conversation ended and be at any pub or any brewery anywhere in the world, where would you want to go? Who would you want to be with? And what would you like to be drinking?
Oh, wow, man. It's a big question. And that's a hard question, too. It's almost like asking me who my favorite band is, but with even more options than who my favorite band is. My first instinct is to say England. Okay. I can't pick a specific pub per se, but having cask that's being poured through a sparkler would be high up on the list. Ordinary bitter, like Landlord or something like that, would be on the list. But see, at the same time, I could see myself at a brewery or a pub in Germany, drinking really well-made lagers. So that's a tough one, John. It's because I'm kind of torn between those two things. I think if I really were held to it, I would probably pick cask ordinary bitter first, just because it's not something that you can get as readily as German lager.
Right.
Probably England somewhere, drinking Landlord on cask poured through a sparkler.
That's a great answer. I love it. Thanks for doing what you do. Thanks for all of the great beers that you've made and the memories that you have created for people. And I'm excited about you being able to share that with folks who need your consulting work and then whatever comes next for you. I know people are going to be following with great interest because where there's great beer, there's great interest, and where you are, there's great beer. Thanks for being on the show this week, Wayne. I really appreciate it.
Excellent. Thank you so much, John. And thank you for all the kind words and support. I really appreciate it.
One more time for all of those who want and frankly need Wayne's consulting services. That email address is waynewombles@yahoo.com. That's WayneWambles, all one word, @yahoo.com. Make sure you reach out today. Who'd you like to hear on the show? Who inside or outside of the beer industry would you like to hear on the air? tell me all about it. My email, it's John Hall, J-O-H-N-H-O-L-L at allaboutbeer.com. That's also how you can get in touch with questions, comments, or anything else that's on your mind. A reminder, please go visit allaboutbeer.com. There you can check out the podcast page, the merch page, and read great new content, as well as the All About Beer archives, which go all the way back to 1979. Follow All About Beer on social media at All About Beer. And if you're interested in supporting journalism in the beer space, and you should be, please email us at info@allaboutbeer.com or go to patreon.com/allaboutbeer. One more time, All About Beer has a podcast channel now. Search and subscribe on your podcast platform of choice. Steal This Beer has new episodes every Monday. The BYO Nano podcast comes out on the 15th of every month. And check out probrewer.com each week for original articles from the All About Beer team. As for this show, Nate Schweber does the music, Jeff Quinn designed our logo, and I'm John Hall. New episodes release every Wednesday, and that's when I'll be back again to drink beer and to think beer.